Be virgin, most pure, pray for us. I try to be very brief and summarize some of the principal points on this conference. I entitled it Hard Cases Make Bad Law. And the hard case in this case is the case of rape, where a woman is unjustly abused, where it's not her fault. This is the presupposition, opposition. Is it possible for her to make use of, quote unquote, in the Connecticut Bishop's pastoral of a year and a half or so ago, emergency contraceptives? And the phrase in question, it seems, well, perhaps it's just a metaphor, but it's one which is not without a certain risk. Up to the present time in the teaching of the church, artificial contraceptives have been considered intrinsically evil. There is no possible way in which you can find circumstances or motives, one kind or another, that would excuse one from making use of something. That is akin, therefore, as it were to murder. If you murder a person, there's no excuse, objectively speaking, for saying it was a good act. After all, it kept me from losing my job. I got rid of the boss who was going. That was a caricature, but to make the point, what is meant by an objective evil, before any consideration of circumstances, intentions, ends, you're describing it had consequential ethics, that sort of thing. You judge the goodness of the badness in terms of its consequences. There's a certain truth in some things. However, there's something far more fundamental in identifying the malice of an act, and that is the character of the object in relationship. What is the object, apart from any personal qualifications? And so the introduction of a phrase like that appears, as it were, to say, in the case of rape, where a woman has been the innocent victim of an injustice, can she do whatever is licit, to resist, as it were, the entrance of the male seed? Up to what point can she go? Can that also include use of contraceptives designed precisely to render the act of intercourse on the part of the woman, well, a woman sterile, therefore fruitless? No pregnancy occurs. Now, in the case of the Connecticut bishops, the actual pill that they were allowed to use without any test for an actual pregnancy having occurred is what is commonly known in the street as the morning after pill. It's not simply contraceptive, it's an abortifacient. Or if we were to clarify our terminology here, it's not abortion in the narrow, strict, traditional sense. Abortion in the traditional sense is not the killing of the child immediately, but the expulsion of the child from the protection of the womb in conditions in which the child cannot survive. If you take a sick person and put him in the outdoors in this weather, what do you think is going to happen? Not you who put the knife in, or as were aim the pistol and shoot, and either at the heart or the brain. It's the cold weather, but you were the one who locked grandma outdoors. You were the one who put the little child who could only survive at that particular point within the protective, you might say, mantle of the mother outside, where the child couldn't survive in those circumstances. This is what abortion was made, born out of due season. St. Paul says of himself, metaphorically, I was one born a Catholic out of due season. I was an apostle out of due season, tanquam abortivo. But when, in fact, artificial measures are taken to get rid of an embryo, therefore a person already conceived, before implantation or afterwards, strictly speaking, it's not abortion, it's infanticide. That was the old infanticidium in the old moral textbooks, was distinguished from abort. The malice is the same. Both are contrary to the fifth commandment, not the sixth, the fifth commandment. Both, as were, put an end to life. A contraceptive act, strictly speaking, prevents the beginning of life where life ought to begin. The whole question is, are we permitted to interfere with what is built into human nature, and only human nature, is capable of procreation of a person? This is what is so serious. It doesn't matter if you stop the cows from breeding too much. You can't, you're a farmer, you can't afford anymore, so you just take the measures necessary. There's no person involved. Now, in effect, in another document that was issued not quite much more than a month ago, it's called Instruction Dignitas Personae from the former Holy Office, Congregation for the Doctrine of Faith, deal with quite a number of questions, certain bioethical questions. It's a very important document because it's very, very specific and detailed. It deals with the questions of in vitro fertilization, what to do with these banks of I don't know how many thousands or maybe millions of frozen embryos. Can you just, as it were, as one priest suggested some years ago, we'll baptize them all and then unfreeze them, get rid of them, throw them in the garbage pail. And they say, no, you can't do that. Or another priest suggested some years ago, well, we find enough women to volunteer to rent their wombs out for a period of time, implant all of these things, and we'll solve the underpopulation problem. And they say, you can't do that either. It's contrary to the personal dignity that is involved. The key issue that Pope Benedict XVI, we must meditate upon that. Otherwise, we will forget our own dignity as persons, and God only knows what kind of a concentration camp the whole world will turn into, where men and women and children and sick people are simply instruments to produce a little bit, little bit more. And then they come, as it were, in number 23 to deal, without mentioning the Connecticut bishops, deal with a question of use of certain chemical means after in an act of intercourse. They don't specify whether it is one which is violent. They simply point out that once there is an embryo, that they don't go into the specific question of contraception as distinct from abortion, but in fact they're saying what was tolerated in the hospitals, including Catholic of Connecticut, because of a new law of the state, which the bishop 3 months before had said they would never tolerate, that you don't have to test for pregnancy to see if there has been a conception. You can just administer what everybody up to this point has known to be, it's called contraceptive, but it's really a morning after. It's an abortifacient. It's either interceptive, preventing the embryo to be implanted, or after implantation, kicking the embryo out so in such wise that it will be expelled and cease to be, as they put it, quote unquote, living, vital in any way. No more got to worry about the unwanted pregnancy. In this case, and here I'll set the issue, in this case, since the intercourse was not agreed to in any shape or form by the woman who was raped, the infant that may have been conceived is an unwanted infant. May you take that position and say that the infant, according to the natural processes built into human nature, which is a personalized nature, which obviously, as the word means, that God wants it. Even in these circumstances, we can contradict. We are getting to the heart, if you want, the phenomenology, metaphysical, that stands behind the whole question of the intrinsic evil of artificial contraception. We're not talking about the case of a woman who is naturally sterile or has difficulties along those lines. That's a completely different question. Ultimately, you are introducing, and I simply pointed out, that there are theologians in this country as well who are suggesting that contraception, therefore, is not intrinsically evil. at least for those who are not married, it's only a biological phenomenon to be judged in terms of the circumstances. Therefore, not only in the case of rape, but the state might ordain that in the case of, let's say, teenage sex, well, the teenagers are irresponsible, but if they're going to do it, they must do it in a safe way. So we'll instruct them as well. Now, from a traditional point of view of Humani Vitae, from the point of view of Pius XI Consti Canubi, that can't be. The tradition of the Church distinguishes between natural sins and unnatural sins in the matters surrounding the use of the marriage act. By that we mean the use of the marriage act, even by those who are not married. For the act of intercourse, of its very nature, prior to the circumstances of those who are making use of the, let's say, two persons who are fornicating, two persons who are not married. Nonetheless, intrinsically, objectively speaking, it's the marriage act. Because the marriage act is primarily, of its very nature, objectively ordained to procreation. What the Church is saying, in Consti Canubi, Pius XI, Paul VI, and Humani Vitae, to interfere with that is to touch what is exclusive to God. And St. Bonaventure specifies, because the power to procreate is a sharing, a unique sharing, no other creature, but men and women share, and especially women, to bring into existence someone who didn't exist before the conception. This is a sharing in the, you might say, divine generosity of the Holy Trinity. The only reason God made us, the only reason He created the world, organized it in a certain way, was love. Love which is not related to or in any way qualified by self-interest. And this is what, as it were, is self-interest is introduced when it is only the pleasure of that act, and there is a great pleasure that is involved, is sought for its own sake apart from procreative generosity. I think I changed the terminology of the book to make the essential point here in the argument. Now, what is the consequence? Answer: what is the connection that Paul II constantly made between the culture of impurity, lust, the old-fashioned term for that, the systematic cultivation of impurity is called the vice of lust, and the systematic promotion of abortion, particularly for, as it were, selfish ends, greed, not just for the love of money, but anything that money will buy, whatever it happens to be, the pleasure of the moment. Between the spread of the contraceptive mentality today, as it were, the vast majority of people in the Western world take it as a perfectly normal thing, although they won't take it as perfectly normal that some would should be naturally tend to pick pockets. If you ever live with a lot of gypsies, that's an amusing thing. Once I was going from a friary in Rome to celebrate Mass in a Marian sanctuary there, going across, and the gypsy lady with three or four youngsters, the oldest one didn't have more than three years old, engaged me in conversation about her terrible situation, etc. Couldn't I help her go over and ask the pastor of the parish of the sanctuary where I was assisting, I wouldn't give a help, and I said, well, I have to go over and hear confessions. There are at least 200 people waiting for me. I can't do anything right now. Father, this and that. And the first thing I felt was some movement, strange movement, in the right side of my tunic, trying to find the opening to the pocket. As it was, there wasn't anything there but a dirty handkerchief. But anyway, the child wasn't quite fully down. The child was probably innocent. I don't know whether there was any subjective guilt. And I said, I looked down, sure it wasn't. I took the little hand out of the pocket. I said, dear, please, you don't want to do something like that. And the mother disappeared immediately, taking the, in other words, saved me a lot of trouble, a lot of trouble. But priests working in Russia have told me, not to blame the Russian people, but after 75 years of systematic atheism, the little children don't have any natural sense that stealing is not the thing to do. They have no sense of guilt. No sense of guilt there. Here I'm not but we must, as it were, admit in the Western world what is true in the Eastern world concerning thievery. There is the same thing. What in the past amongst Christians, not including, as it were, non-Catholic, up until 1929, the Lambeth Conference, which was the first major Protestant group to legitimize contraception on a limited scale. Today, as it were, even before Humani Vitae, I can remember, as were even when I was younger, more and more Catholics were taken for granted. There's nothing particularly wrong with this. Nothing. It's simply a prohibition of the church. Why do the priests keep preaching, insisting in the confessional, and so on, as priests were commanded to do before the council? It wasn't always explained carefully what was involved, the why behind it. But the why behind it is what Pope John Paul II tried to make clear in a retreat he preached to after the Humani Vitae to Pope Paul VI, to the entire Roman Curia, and then throughout his entire pontificate. There is a link between contraception and abortion. Abortion is not something that people normally desire. And when they see pictures of what happens, they are revolted. Of the child in the womb. It's one of the most effective ways sometimes to dissuade people people when they see what it's really all about. But abortion basically is desired as a backup for an unwanted child. Now the whole question here, the second question that must be reflected upon here, is it possible to say simply because the circumstances of the conception involved a rape that the child is guilty? It's an invader. Here we must, as the world recognizes, the profound problem. How far may we go in insisting that what we don't want, God should not impose upon us? Especially if it involves the existence of another person. We may not have wanted, we may not have chosen that, that's fine. No one has to choose to be married. But where we get to the point where the very heart of marriage, what makes it so unique as a contract, as a covenant is involved, there we must begin to draw, as in the case of beginning to cut somebody up when he's declared brain dead. These are, as it were, key points where something more than the particular circumstances of rape or the particular need of organ transplant is involved. We must recognize that there are higher principles involved, principles, as it were, that we should seek to understand, because they place, as it were, the spiritual life in proper perspective. And if we get rid of it, we still have a spiritual life, but whether it will be a holy, a genuinely humane spiritual life is a completely different question. Wherever a society has sister, I don't say this is the proof, but I point to it as a point of history, which indicates that there is a mystery involved, and our refusal even to consider the point already, as it were, makes our attitudes and comportment suspect. It is a historical fact that communities, nations, whole cultures that have systematically introduced contraception and abortion have ceased to exist and even be remembered. The culture of impurity leads willy-nilly to the culture of death. Curtains of Wild, that was a story I read, a book came out about 30 years ago entitled Murder, Inc. Was all about whodunits and their author. There's a little chapter about the dude from New York who goes out to Las Vegas or someplace out there in the Wild West in the days when all the deserted mining towns were really prosperous, and he came into the saloon and started showing how really proficient he was as an authentic cowboy, shooting up the saloon as fast as he could. And the old cowhand sitting there, he said, "Speed's great, partner. Accuracy's final." And will you? That's well. The culture of death. Death is final. There is nothing but resurrection. And God does not raise cultures up. He raises persons. Therefore, we don't want to, in our consideration, we don't want to reflect on probably everybody in one way or another was influenced at one point in this particular time by the contraceptive mentality. And it's probably true that the majority of Catholics at one time or another may have practiced contraception. That doesn't mean that Christ won't forgive them. But it does mean that we must see clearly what are the dangers here, not only for the individuals, but especially in the case of contraception, for the entire community. What do you do when you get old and there are no children around? That's when you're the last generation. This is what happened. One of the fathers, you can read the fathers of the church carefully, people like St. Augustine, they drop hints here and there. What was going on in the Western Roman Empire at the time of the barbarian? You can't blame it all on the barbarians, the fall of the Roman Empire. You can't blame it on the church. St. Augustine points out precisely this was going on. That the native Romans, the cultured Romans, weren't having children anymore. Except those who were Christians, and some of the Christians weren't faithful. That was the problem. The Roman Empire didn't fall because the Roman army wasn't very efficient at that time. But the Roman armor, like so many other things in Rome at that time, was paralyzed precisely by the consequences of a systematic promotion of impurity, which in earlier ages the Romans had. We're talking only about not the mystery of purity that is so close to divinity. I'm referring to Our Lady's virginity. It was a virgin mother that made the divine accessible to us. Made the Son of the Father, the Son of Adam, one of us. We must remember that always. The Mother of God is the Virgin Mother. That doesn't mean St. Joseph didn't have a role, he did. That's also most important because the promotion of this sort of thing has also undermined in the Western world sound spirituality of men. The promotion of lust keeps the male like an irresponsible adolescent. He can escape his responsibilities, and the woman, if there is a conception, the woman is stuck with the child. I say stuck, this is the way the world sees it. The child is still a blessing, but it's hard on the woman. It's a fact, as it were, that the problems of the male adolescent over age, will only be solved when we return to a sound Christian spirituality. And there are many Protestant groups who realize that as well, all the men groups that are being formed. Now I see, as it were, the same movement amongst Catholics to restore a sense of masculine purity and strength that is founded on fidelity. You don't walk out on your responsibilities. It makes the difference between the immature and the genuinely mature man. The passage, as it were, from a psychological and social stage in which the individual male is not capable of his own and taking on. But when he does, and if he is faithful, it doesn't matter whether he's 15 or 50. It's the same thing. He will be a true adult. But again, as it were, that is what is looked for from his wife. But so often we find, as it were, just the opposite. But I notice that there are many, many, it's a sign of hope, young men, Catholics, and also non-Catholics, who are being drawn precisely to this ideal. The only reason I bring up this case here is to point out, and here I come quickly to the conclusion, because I know there are a lot of questions, both for myself and for Dr. Brown, is to point out the connection between sins which involve a rejection of that generosity involved in procreating giving existence and life, human life, to another person that didn't exist exist before, and on the other end, as it were, to assume the right to declare this person can be killed, or this person can be persuaded to agree to assisted suicide and a host of other things, simply because it is to the advantage of another. There is a direct connection, on the one hand, between lust, using this precious power simply for my personal pleasure, and doing these other things simply for my personal advantage. It's better you die than I should die. On what grounds do I make that statement? Because if I got your heart, I could live for another 50 years. Maybe I could. But who says I have a prior right to live over that of the man who it may be close to death? Maybe he's only 4 minutes away. But that's beside the point. Why is my right to 50 more years better than his right to 5 more minutes? You're mathematizing, or in the words of a bit cruder than the ones I would have dared to use, Benedict XVI, you're commercializing medicine. I don't mean doctors shouldn't get what is called a salary support. They should. And it should be generous. But a doctor, like a lawyer, above all, like a priest, is not in it to become a millionaire. He is a man who is dedicated to helping others first. Everybody recognizes that. Everybody wants to go to a general, as in old time, but even today, they're looking for a general practitioner who is a genuine, dedicated person. They don't mind helping to support him. But just as they don't mind a good priest, but they don't like a priest who's trying to take advantage of his position simply for his own personal pleasure. That's another matter. And this is why there is a canon in the law of the church that says priests are entitled to a good living. But anything over and above that, they are ultimately got to give to the church, give back to the church, or give it to the poor. They cannot become millionaires as clergymen. Their patrimony from their families is another matter. It's important, but it's still there. And the same mentality governed teachers in the olden times in Europe, to a certain extent, professors of the university don't get the kind of salaries they get in this country. But conversely, as it were, it's not as expensive to get a doctorate in Europe as it is here. Yeah. I'm not talking about who is paying for. I'm simply pointing out we should never commercialize education. Make it a business. We shouldn't commercialize medicine as we don't commercialize religion. There's a connection between these things. And this is one of the things, as it were, why it's so interesting to meditate on the spiritual implications of certain principles here. At the end of this, here as a sufficient on number 23, if you want to look up what they say they don't comment directly on the question I'm treating, but they do comment sufficiently to know that you can't administer the morning after pill in the cases of rape without being involved, or at least implicitly intending an abortion. And they say they're not going to the question of the nature of the pill given, but everyone pretty much knows that the pill that is being given in Connecticut is precisely what I called it. There are four points. Points that I thought worth of discussion, but I'm not going into them. One, from all Israel, we don't have a right to reconstruct our human nature. At those points which are essential and distinctive and necessary for our personal dignity, I said our, because we can never totally isolate. No man is an island, was one of the 17th century English writers. Yesterday was a nephew of St. Thomas More, who were conformed. But anyway, it's a very valid point. Right? We are persons, but we're also part of a community. So I say our. We may not promote, accept, approve an attempt to radically reconstruct human nature, for instance, as it were, cloning and all that, to design a child just the way I want him. Not want him. Well, that's what he says. The child becomes simply the tool of the parents. That is not the love that God wants us to have. There are limits unto what we can do with our technology. All these things are possible, intelligible, etc. But it is important to note, intelligibility in itself, possibility in itself, is not a synonym for reasonableness. Or I will use the word of St. Augustine, ratio ordinis, a tranquil order. This is what has worked, brings joy. If you introduce a disorder, my Scotus, you're introducing something which is radically destructive. It's radically arbitrary. And where the will is considered as simply an arbitrary, God is omnipotent, so he can do whatever he pleases. Murder is wrong today, tomorrow again. This was called nominalism, voluntarism. The Pope referred to that, but unfortunately he said that's what Scotus taught. That's not true. But there are people yesteryear and today who teach that sort of thing. The arbitrary will, whether it is the divine will of conceived by John Calvin, or the human will, not the same thing. If I had omnipotence, I'd remake the rules at the fifth inning. If you take the baseball, how those who attempt to change the rules of baseball when they're losing are considered considered not worthy of competing against in sports, because they're unfaithful, because they're dishonest. You can call it intellectual dishonesty, you can call it lack of sportsmanship, and etc. But the essential point is there. Secondly, we must recognize here, we cannot remake it. There is a radical difference between not because natural sins are good, they're very bad, but natural sins in the case of the sixth commandment respect one of the intrinsic, basic fundamentals of human nature, the power to procreate. We can't do that. Even in cases, you can't use that as a means to, as it were, prevent the entry or the fecundation by the male seed. That's the whole issue here. It's a test case. If you, as in the case of the brain death, organ transplants, killing somebody before they're actually really dead in order to get the organs, once you make this exception, you open the door. You not only got your crack of the door open, you have kicked it open, you don't know what's going to follow. But you will end up dehumanizing everybody and every society. Natural sin, that is, draws limits on how far you go. Unnatural sin is that which attempts, as it were, to reject, act contrary, directly and immediately, to what touches the very generosity of God, according to St. Bonaventure. Once you admit that contraception may be all right in certain cases, you have basically denied the distinction between natural and unnatural, which is traditional and textbooks of moral theology, right up to the council. There is no difference between premarital and postmarital sex, except the fact that you're required to go before the justices of the peace or have the benefit of clergy or whatever. But it's the same thing. Both are equally good. There is no difference, as it were, between intercourse that is illicit, but it's open, and the child is conceived. They call them illegitimate, but the child itself is not. That is only a legal term to indicate the lack of wedlock, out of wedlock, as sort of phrases of this type. But the child is perfectly legitimate in himself. Is as much a person as I am now. And I know many persons, as it were, who were born illegitimates, but they're holy priests. And some of them may have even been canonized. We don't know all the circumstances. We're dealing with different questions. You break down the difference between heterosexual and homosexual acts. Why? Because the only reason for either one is simply pleasure. If you get your pleasure in one way, who am I to tell you it's wrong? If that's the only criterion. And finally, you ultimately end up breaking down the difference between human intercourse and intercourse between a man and a beast. What once was called buggery. Nobody understands the meaning of the term. But if anybody calls you a bugger, it's not a compliment. Even in the... No, this is what... unfortunately, this sort of thing, you don't hear much about it, but it is turning up every so often. When you think about a man, is to reduce a man to the level of the beast. Not to recognize that there is a radical, unbridgeable difference between even the most sophisticated beast, being a sophisticated robot, whatever you want, and a human person. That's the second point. The third point is redefinitions of natural law. The old-fashioned notion was physicalist, meaning there's no difference in the old-fashioned Catholic understanding of natural law, being in the natural law as it was understood by a biologist. There's nothing wrong with natural law in the sense that it pertains, as it were, to the operation, the rules, the laws governing the way in which, as it were, a cow gets produces milk, gets milk, and so on and so forth. The use is put to it. But natural law, when it is referred to man, introduces an essential difference into the nature of the law, because the nature is different. The nature is a personal one. It's not physicalist. It's metaphysical. And there is a personalist, but it's meta-personal. Now, the theory is, contraception is only intrinsically wrong when married people, because they're acting against their promise, as were, to be open to procreation. This is not the original teaching of Christ and the Church. And the final point is the relation between natural law and Christ. All of us, whether we're Christian or not, are obliged by the natural law. And if we follow St. Paul, as we must, we say, not only those who received the Mosaic law, not only those who received the Christian law will be judged by the Redeemer, because he is the promised Redeemer, foretold by Moses, but all the descendants of Adam, every last one of them, will be judged by Christ. He is the only final judge. Therefore, we must recognize that the natural law, by itself, will not save, just as the Mosaic law by itself. Well, this is the teaching. It is grace. Nonetheless, both the natural law and the Mosaic law, at least for a time, were the natural preparations, foundations for the Christian law, which completed that. Grace perfects nature. Now, Lord, in the Sermon on the Mount, declared, there is, of course, a leap. There is a difference, and it has to be bridged. But there is also a continuity. Not one iota, not one little tittle of the law will go unfulfilled. It is his intention primarily to complete, to consummate, to bring to perfection. And this is what we insist upon. When it is not true that salvation is intended only for certain groups, or Christian salvation only to those who become Christian, is for everyone. That everyone, as it were, will arrive where we are. We must keep that in mind in our defense. It's not only defending our party's point of view. We are concerned not only with the survival, but with the salvation of every last soul, every last person for whom Christ died.